Terri Schiavo's name doesn't appear in the headlines much these days, but her story continues to ripple through state legislatures across the country, trying to wrestle with end-of-life issues. Hi, welcome to the Bioethics Channel, a production of the Center for Practical Bioethics. For more information about the center and its programs, visit practicalbioethics.org. That's practicalbioethics.org. John Carney joins us. He is the Vice President for Aging and End of Life at the Center for Practical Bioethics. Hard to believe, John, that it will soon be 5 years since the Terri Schiavo case burst onto the national stage. What effects do we still experience from that story?
Well, I think, Laurel, Americans are pretty conflicted over this issue and have remained conflicted for a long time. They understand, I think we've got a good job of helping people understand that the kinds of decisions that you make at the end of life are really different than the kinds of decisions you make when earlier in life or when you're healthy or when there's a tragic accident or something like that. But as you approach that indefinite period or that prolongation of that condition that's continuing to worsen, that the issues are different. I think we saw that played out very dramatically over the course of the summer with healthcare reform and the whole concerns around death panels. The conflict, I think, really resolves around people not wanting government involved in the decision-making process and making sure that we protect that sacred relationship between provider and professional provider and the patient. But there's also this recognition that we can't continue the path that we've been on for the last 20 years. So that's the conflict, is there has to be a reasonable approach, but we also don't want government involved in that decision-making process.
Big picture, nationally, what are the primary efforts underway to address end-of-life issues that were reflected in the Schiavo case?
There are a number of provisions in the healthcare reform legislation that remained even after the discussions this summer with the death panels that will help us deal with the issues around, especially around end of life and the very complex decisions. And a lot of that has to do with comparative effectiveness and innovations and bundling of payments that really, when you look at where does it that the United States spends money, it's around those kinds of conditions and situations. So there's a real effort to say what works, what doesn't work, what's helpful, what's not helpful, what's beneficial care, what's really important for people, and helping clarify some of those issues. So those remain, and I think we're going to see those played out certainly over the course of the next 5 years, if not sooner. And some of that's coming out of good data that's been continuing to resonate with the Dartmouth Atlas report that looks at those Medicare claims. We're going to see a lot of good information, I think, and some innovation come from this, especially around advanced care planning.
Drilling down to more of the state-level issues that the Center for Practical Bioethics pays attention to, in Missouri and Kansas, we're working with legislators to address measures aimed at specific situations with end of life. In Missouri, it's the out-of-hospital do not resuscitate law. Tell us about that.
Well, it took effect in August of this last year after the regulation was finally written. It kind of languished for about a year in terms of that happening. And we've had some concerns around the fact that it's really a law that protects liability for EMS personnel, making sure that they can honor a directive or an instruction or an order from a doctor. And there was some confusion around how that would actually be implemented in the nursing home in terms of if everybody had to fill out these forms now and you had to have an agent sign. And so there's been some concern around that. We got some very, very good clarification from the Department of Health and Senior Services and the licensure departments just this last week, and that will be getting out to the different providers, the hospice and palliative care, home health agencies, and long-term care associations in the state of Missouri. It's been a kind of a rough ride, but I think we're going to get some clarification. What basically it boils down to is that if somebody wants to ask a doctor to write an order for them not to be resuscitated, that's within their purview and they can do it. If they are in a condition where they can no longer state what they want and they haven't named an agent, a physician still has the responsibility and the ability to write an order to limit that kind of attempt when the patient can't benefit from resuscitation.
Now talk about the patients that would most generally be most interested in something like this.
Well, it's going to be the people who are already involved in taking care of chronic conditions for themselves, or they're approaching the end of life themselves and they know that. They've got a terminal condition, they've been sick for a while, or they've had multiple chronic conditions, and they really want to limit those kinds of attempts. They know themselves they can't benefit from it. The person who actually kind of became the face for this for the law in Missouri is a three-time survivor of cancer. She has a significant heart condition, and she's simply saying, if I were to arrest, I don't want to be resuscitated. That's the kind of patient that law is really intended to serve.
Now, in Kansas and Missouri, the center is working around efforts to merge or streamline laws around the end of life.
In Kansas, we're actually trying to combine two laws, the agent law, the appointment of your agent, and then the other law that deals with the directive, what we say we want or don't want, the living will law. We're trying to combine those into one using the uniform code, and then also adding to that mix an ability for the state to identify surrogacy, so kind of this, as we call it, kind of a pecking order of who gets to decide. So that would alleviate the problems of cases going to court and those kind of things so that we can actually have a hierarchy that we use in helping determine who should we go to if the patient hasn't named somebody and now we need to act on their behalf. It makes it far more workable for hospitals and for the courts to be able to deal with the issue.
Likelihood that something like this will be passed this year or that regulations will go into a place to address those kinds of issues?
It's a very, very delicate compromise on the state of Kansas. Life protection issues are very important in the legislature, as they are for many of us. And there's a significant recognition that this compromise from a more conservative life protection stance to a more progressive, we need to make sure that we're not hurting people when we do things to them at the end of life that actually can hurt them. There's a very delicate compromise. And I've worked on that for 2 years with many other people, not only at the center but throughout the state. I'm not sure whether we'll be able to keep the compromise together. If it doesn't, we're going to stay at it and try to reintroduce it again, I'm sure, in another form, another fashion. But right now the hope is that we'd be able to get the compromise through and get it into law.
Another project in Kansas, very similar to the out-of-hospital DNR in Missouri, is something we affectionately call TPOPP, and that's an acronym TPOPP. Explain that, if you would, please.
That stands for the Transportable Physician Orders for Patient Preferences. And basically what it is it takes the concerns around frail elderly and those with advanced disease states and says, CPR is not the only thing that we should be concerned about with these people in terms of whether it can benefit them or not. So do not resuscitate is not the only issue. We should be concerned about those patients when they go into a hospital setting, whether they can benefit from surgeries, whether they want to be hooked up to ventilators and breathing machines and things like that, or whether they want to go into the ICU. Can we really benefit from them going into the ICU? They may need to go to the hospital to address pain or bleeding issues or other kinds of things, but they don't necessarily benefit from an ICU admission where other things happen to them. So this particular order set that a doctor signs addresses all of those issues, and then it's transportable. That order follows the patient from the nursing home into the hospital, back out to, say, long-term care or acute care setting, a subacute setting, and then back over to the home or back to the nursing home. So it follows the patient wherever they go.
You describe all that, and I'm thinking, a patient and a family are all in a very sensitive, vulnerable position while all of this is going on. And then you have all of these different entities kind of parachuting in and out, from EMS to doctors to hospitals. That just sounds so complicated and so difficult, overwhelming, to try to deal with it.
It can be overwhelming. And I think the hope here with the TPOPP, the physician order set, is that there would be significant conversations that take place with both the patient and the family members around each type of intervention and what the success of those interventions would mean, because they are different. Attempts at resuscitation are different than whether or not I want to have another surgery or whether or not I want to end up in ICU. And the kinds of things that can happen in an environment like Kansas City versus a hospital, say, in the southwest part of the state where it's really a critical access hospital and they really can't do much more than basically assess and start some, preliminary interventions. If that patient wants to stay there because they're in the throes of dying and it's really better for them to stay local, that's the kind of decision-making process that needs to be really vetted with the family. And so our hope is that it becomes less overwhelming. Right now it is, because none of these conversations usually take place except at the moment.
And I've seen the form, too, or the draft form. And when you think about bureaucraties, take a picture of that. You know, it is, and you see it.
It's two-sided, but it is all in one place. That's what we're trying to do is get it all in one place and then actually have that be a reflection of a series of conversations that have taken place. And in some cases, some of those sections won't be filled out. They'll just be left blank, which is okay. But it also then prompts those questions later on to say, you know, we really never talked about this yet. Are you guys ready to talk about this? Is this something important to you? If the answer is no, you leave it alone. But it also helps us clarify contradictory kinds of things. As yes, I want everything, but, oh, I would never want that. Or even getting the family to be able to say, well, the kids might want it, but the patient might not.
Let's say we're 5 years in the future now, in the year 2015, and that's 10 years after Terry Schiavo died. What will the landscape look like in terms of all of us making our wishes known when we're seriously ill at the end of life and we can't speak for ourselves?
I'm hopeful that it'll be a much more robust and intimate conversation between the healthcare provider and the patient or the family, the person who's needing to make the decisions related to significant invasive kinds of decisions, you know, aggressive kinds of care decisions. I'm also aware of the fact that there's going to be a lot more people in this situation. In 10 years, we're halfway down the pike of the baby boomers, you know, getting to the age where these kinds of situations are going to be affecting them.
What is it, in 2012, 10,000 people a day will turn 65, something like that?
And in the next 20 years, we're going to go from basically 1 in 10 in the population to 1 in 5 in the population. The fastest growing group right now is over 85. In 10 years, the fastest growing group will be over 100. So just the complexity of the decisions around dementia and those kinds of things are going to complicate this issue. So we've got to pay attention now and begin the conversations, because it takes us as a nation a good decade to grapple with some of these issues. And I think the clarity around that we've gotten over the last 5 years with Terry Schiavo, I don't think ever going to see the Congress step in to a hornet's nest like they did with Terry Schiavo again. I don't care who's in the White House or who's in Congress. I think it was very clear that that was not a place that Americans wanted Congress to go. So that fear about government intervention is there. I do think, however, that these issues are very complex, very personal, and really rely on the professional and the patient relationship to really be made meaningful and really sacred in that relationship between the two.
John Carney is the Vice President for Aging and End of Life at the Center for Practical Bioethics. I'm Laurel LeBoux. Thanks for listening to the Bioethics Channel.